Fusion Patrol is brought to you in part by our patrons at patreon.com/fusionpatrol. We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we are looking at the Blake 7 Series 3 episode, Volcano, by the infamous Alan Pryor. Tarrant and Dana are set down on the planet Obsidian, a volcanic planet with only one volcano. They've come to look for a strategic base where they can run a mercenary army and track down the rumor that Blake has been here. Dana knows of the people on the planet because they once had a guy who was friends with her dead father, and that makes for great alliances. They track the people down, but not before the people track them down, and they capture them, but nicely, because they are total pacifists. Meanwhile, Servalan, who is not a total pacifist, in her new whale ship, is coming to Obsidian because they have a plan. They want to capture the Liberator and use the planet as a strategic base because it's a very strategic planet, but weirdly was never invaded by anyone, including the Federation. The plans go fairly well. I mean, Tarrant and Dana can't actually get anywhere with a pacifist because, well, they're pacifists and they don't want to be doing the fighty stuff. And Servalan's plan is being helped by someone on the inside who turns out to be the lead guy's son, who turns out isn't so pacifist after all and has betrayed everyone to Servalan because they're the strongest and they need to survive. The Liberator is almost destroyed, almost captured, but is not destroyed and is not captured. And the people on the planet Obsidian, in an effort to prove that they are indeed pacifists to the end, blow themselves up along with their planet. Servalan wins. Nobody gets the strategic base. Avon and the crew don't get a strategic base. But it's all good. It's all good in the end. Okay. Volcano.
Yeah?
One of the classic all-time episodes of Blake 7.
Is it really?
Considered to be the milestone in writing achievement, I think, in the series.
Oh, says who?
Alan Pryor, maybe?
I mean, this might be a milestone in the mundane.
This episode is pretty, it's not very good.
It's not awful, but a paperweight has more entertainment value than this episode does.
I guess it depends on the paperweight. Are you talking about one that's got like a snow in it or like a
like a snow globe? Something pretty to look at, you know, something like that. Sure. I mean, it's more entertaining than this.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It's all right. Yeah. It's not a very good episode. Let's just put our cards on the table here. It's not a very good episode, and it doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense either. So for starters, it appears that the crew of the Liberator have not yet found Blake. Or, in fact, they're not even sure where to look for Blake, it sounds
And I'm beginning to sense a pattern here. I'm sensing this pattern of, it's like, where is Blake this week rumor?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's what I'm beginning to sense here. And I will say that he better turn up pretty soon, because if he doesn't, this gimmick is going to get really old really fast.
And of course, obviously you can't keep calling the show Blake 7 if Blake isn't in it. I mean, we know the show goes for another 2 years. So
well, at that point, my greatest hope then will be that Villa dies.
Oh, but he was so helpful in this episode. He did, yeah, okay. he got the adrenaline and soma and offered it to Avon, which is very nice of him.
Oh yeah, but I'm thinking about that scene in the teleport. The teleport room
where Callie
he said, we need to beam them up now, you know, and then he beams them up and oh, guess what? It's an armed invasion force. How nice of you.
Yeah. Yeah. Why didn't you just flip the switches and beam them right back down again?
Because it's Villa.
Yeah. Well, Callie could have done that.
That's true.
Just reach right up, hit the switches, run them back, send them back down.
Yeah, but I think this episode was maybe Alan Parr's got one virtue going for him, and that is he does not like Villa whatsoever, and he wants to make him look like a complete bonehead. And had Callie been able to actually reverse the teleport, then it would have minimized Villa's boneheadedness.
Well, I mean, yeah. I don't know. Does he have something in for him?
I'm guessing.
He wrote
Horizon, Hostage, and The Keeper.
Hostage. Oh, that one. Oh, yeah. He didn't like, and then Villa was stupid in The Keeper, too.
He was stupid in The Keeper.
There's one thing, though. He knows that Callie has telepathic powers. I'm going to give Alan Pryor this. So Horizon is a good example.
Yeah, but there's something weird about the telepathy these days. It was interesting how she could try to issue warnings, and except for Dana, no one was hearing it, and even then she wasn't quite getting it right.
I'm getting the impression that Avon was really busy.
That was my first thought. That he was heavily distracted, which is why he wasn't picking it up.
Right. Why Callie would be able to send a message to Dana and Tarrant, not knowing that it's Dana and Tarrant up there. But I guess maybe she can just broadcast anyone. How then also would she know that it's... there was like, go to the rim. They're hiding by the rim, by the rim, by the rim. And then they go, oh, it wants us to go by the rim.
Yeah. I thought, oh, really?
That's not the best interpretation of that. But then when they get there and the Federation guys have the drop on them, she goes, it's to your left. How could she see that? She was stuck under the cave. So
this kind of goes back to a lot of what we've suspected, that Callie can do more than just send. She is capable of sensing on some level, although that was pretty strong, more so than anything we've seen her do recently.
Okay, here's another thing that Callie is not strong on: counting. So after Avon is got the drop on the bridge, he does receive Callie's message at that point, where she's down in the teleport room saying, Avon, there are three of them. Wouldn't it have been more helpful if she'd told him that there were four of them? Because there were.
Unless she was only aware of three.
She saw all four beam up.
I know, I'm trying to rationalize
nice
and I'm doing a bad job, yeah. It was pretty lame.
It was worse than lame. It was like, how did you make that mistake?
Writing mistake? I don't know.
It's got to be what it is.
Like, I can only imagine that Alan wrote it as three, but when they actually blocked it, they threw in a fourth person in there and then didn't bother to even rewrite the script for continuity's sake.
Because he doesn't only kill the three on the bridge. Well, he kills two on the bridge, and then there's the one, the captain, who escapes. So, I mean, there were three that went to the bridge, but surely you'd tell him there were four of them on the ship, not that there are three coming to the bridge. That's the only...
Well, like I said, I think it's probably a writing mistake. They probably... Alan wrote it for three. That's probably how many were supposed to beam up, and maybe when they were going into production, it was decided, oh, let's put a fourth in there because it just looks better. It's more threatening, and it will... Our crew will very much be outnumbered at that point. And then they just forgot to alter the script after that.
Yeah.
The only thing I can really come up with here.
Well, I think we're stretching anything other than just...
You know, but really, you know, that's actually not too implausible if you really think about it. I mean, how many times has there been a late second production change in something? You know, when they're working on episode, let's do this and let's do, you know, and quickly fix this here and this other thing. And then maybe the script writer isn't there. And they don't have somebody who is actually monitoring the script for continuity's sake, and then just they just blow right past and forget that it's even there.
Let me ask you a question then. And obviously they could do this in any order they want, but do they not usually do audio overdubbing at the end of the process?
Oh, you mean looping?
Yeah. So when she's doing the voiceover for There Are Three of Them, Avon, that's probably done after shooting was done.
Oh, that's true.
So, I don't know. We're just picking. We're picking.
Maybe she was given a bad script.
Hey, there's one thing about
yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say one thing about it, Alan Pryor's writing. He has got the Terry Nation planet naming thing going. Obsidian for a volcanic planet.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
At least it's not Volcano-O or,
or Vulcan.
Magmatron or something.
Magmatron. Ah.
That would be the gun.
Lavalopolis.
Yeah. Lavalopolis. Yes. I like that one. Lavalopolis. Anyway, yeah.
That would be the capital city, Lavalopolis.
So why were these people called the Pyroans?
The Pyroans, I believe, is what they're called.
Pyro, fire.
Fire. Yeah. Well, because they live with...
Wouldn't they be the Obsidians? Obsidonians?
Or the Lava Owens.
Yeah.
Too Hawaiian. It's too Polynesian.
What is the word that they use for lava in Hawaii? They've got...
I don't know.
They actually name lava types using Hawaiian words because it's like the old joke about Eskimos have 37,000 different words for snow depending on its type. The Hawaiians have... This is true, unlike the snow thing. They have specific different names for the types of volcanic rock that are deposited around the islands. And so it's more specific than what we had. So
well, like they, one they possible word I understand is like a – oh, man, I can't even pronounce that.
Yeah, it's like
– a pahoi?
There we go. You're talking in that kind of range, yeah. Yeah,
I'm looking at it right now. P-A-H-O-E-H-O-E. Pahoehoe. I'm guessing.
See, that would have been a great name for the planet. Or the people. Pahoehoeans.
Yeah, they also have the...
There's like one that's...
Holoholo.
Yeah.
Holoholo is one. Yeah, they got different... Yeah, you're right. I mean, there's just like a lava rocks, lava flow. They actually do use the word lava at one point. The language, yeah, something like that would have been really nice, but maybe calling them Lava Owens would just sound a little bit too close.
Too Terry Nation.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that's it. Yeah, too Terry Nation.
I'm sorry, Terry. I hope I didn't steal that from you from some other show you were going to write someday.
Yeah, and meanwhile, you'd see, cut over to Terry, and he's grumbling as he's scribbling something out of his script.
Oh, there goes my next Doctor Who script.
Yeah.
Doctor Who and the Planet of the Volcano. Damn.
The Daleks were living in a lava dome and an ice volcano, and the natives they were enslaving the natives, and the natives were called the Lava Loans.
okay, so
Pyroans is what they were
Pyroans,
called.
Yes. Weird that they would. Also have a sort of volcanic-y, fiery...
You know, I hate to say it, but it's almost kind of comic book-y because for so many years and decades, not so much today, but in the 50s, I would even say even earlier, 30s into the 80s, I mean, planet names and the inhabitants were given just some of the kitschiest names. They were just pathetic. And Pyroans kind of really sits right on top of that heap.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not very intelligent.
There's definitely is a vibe, a 50s vibe. Now, let's try to treat this as a serious subject.
What?
To be fair, if you were out there in your space hopper flying along and you come across a planet and you get to name it, Obsidian's not that bad. If it were a volcanic planet, I would like to think there was obsidian on the planet somewhere. But, you know, I can sort of see some of the silly names that people have come up with, because in a way they kind of remind me of some of the silly names that they gave things out west in the United States. You know, you'd get to a place and it's like, oh, look, two trees. Let's call this two trees.
Yeah. Or no, you're quite right. I mean, there's an area called 29 Palms, and I'm sure that at one time someone said, oh, look, let's count. Oh, there's 29 Palms. Right. Hey, I have an idea.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, maybe that's the idea, that this is sort of the way that the frontier of space went, is mankind going out and people coming up with lame names for planets.
Right. It's very possible.
This planet is my destiny. Let's call it Destiny.
Yeah, exactly.
So
it is very possible.
Well, since there's no life out there.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think we've seen anything that really, by and large, everything's human-based.
Yeah, we really haven't seen...
Callie's people, maybe. They might not be human-based.
But they're still very humanoid.
Yes.
At the very least. I mean, we haven't seen anything that was like outrageously
the Andromedans, but...
Yeah, we never saw them, though.
Well...
We just know that they're there. Bits,
yeah, but... Yeah, but they're... I mean, they're the first truly alien race that we've encountered, I think, in Blake 7.
Yeah.
By and large, it's just the human frontier, so...
And when someone found that planet Obsidian, they probably noticed that in addition to it being of a very singular, important volcano, they said, oh, look, there's all this Obsidian here.
I know. Let's put an atomic bomb in it.
Yeah, really.
That's what I would be thinking. I think, yeah, bomb.
This would be a good place.
Let's talk a little bit about Tarrant before we talk about the Pyroans. Tarrant's only been around here 2.1 episodes now.
Yeah, barely 2.1.
And they're playing up his space captaincy in this episode a little bit. No, oh, you're a space captain. I was a space captain once, you know, till I got out, till I defected. They're definitely going for the mercenary vibe for both Tarrant and the crew of the Liberator, for that matter. They seem to be, it's like, yeah, this whole political thing, I think we're done with that. Let's do some mercenary stuff. That's what it sounds like. Is that Tarrant's influence? Or is that the group decision? Is that what Avon wants to do? It's never really clear why they've decided that this planet, that they need to start setting up a base. And
it is not very clear. Funny thing is, I'm still not entirely sure that I'm getting that vibe from Tarrant. Probably for the same reason I'm not entirely sure where that vibe is coming from in the first place, how that all came to be. I'm thinking this is just the perfect combination of elements, and this is what came out of it. It's the only thing I can think of, because we're not seeing any one person spearhead this mercenary kind of idea.
Okay, so there's two reasons to go to the planet. One is for its strategic importance. And two is to chase down the rumor that Blake is there. And if you listen to what Avon says, he's not at all interested in that. Right? He says basically, you know, dozens, we could be chasing rumors of Blake forever.
Yeah.
So he's clearly interested in the strategic advantage of the planet.
It's got to be more of the strategic, because especially if a mercenary lifestyle is what they are exploring, then the last thing I would be thinking about is trying to find Blake, because he would be doing everything in his obsessive idealistic viewpoint to kind of put a stop to that.
If I were Avon and Blake were off the ship, I would not go looking for him.
No, I wouldn't. If I were Avon, I would not be looking for him, especially if I feel like I finally have what I really want now.
Mm-hmm. So, Tarrant is explaining to the Pyroans that, you know, you get a share of the spoils. He is talking piracy. He is talking raiding, victory of spoils of war. I mean, he is trying to sell them on the idea that we're going to, you know, get people together and then we're gonna go out and do stuff. This does not sound like an idealistic enterprise. This sounds like pirates, marauders, mercenaries, whatever it happens to be. Maybe forming together in mutual defense against what's left of the Federation, but still.
Well, they've got nothing better to do at this point. The Federation is all in ruins, pretty much.
Can you imagine? I mean, I can see Avon doing that to some degree. Tarrant is an unknown commodity. Dana? Villa is easy. Yes, he'd
do
it.
Oh, God, yeah. But Dana is, she's, man, I can't pin her down on this one.
I'm holding the one off that makes no sense at all to last, of course. Callie? Callie's almost in the Blake category.
She pretty much almost is.
This does not seem like the kind of thing she would.
No, she would not be going along with it. But then again, we're back to what was her cause in the first place. Her cause was to see the elimination of the Federation. So, yes, she was very much in the Blake camp. But as we said, the Federation now really consists, to me, it seems more like a bit of a ragtag fleet.
Yeah, Tarrant says a substantial portion of the Federation fleet. I think we heard, didn't we hear two-thirds of the fleet was destroyed?
Yes, we did.
So one-third of the fleet is not an insubstantial number.
Not necessarily, but that's stretching it pretty thin. No, but it's still stretching it pretty thin. I'm just assuming that the size of the fleet was determined totally based on the needs and the size of the Federation itself.
Well, so here's what you'd do, tactically. If you had an empire, and you lost two-thirds of your peacekeeping force, shall we say. My guess is, and obviously unlike Earth history where you've got continents and oceans and whatnot, you have basically a big ball of space radiating out from Earth, that you'd simply contract your sphere.
Yes.
Into the largest area you can patrol logically around Earth.
Yes, so absolutely.
It sounds like they had a substantial portion of the galaxy, and if not all of it, and now they're going to control a chunk of, you know, whatever that size is.
And much closer to Earth, I would imagine.
That would leave nobody else with anything major.
No, so everything else in the outer areas of the galaxy is pretty much up for grabs at this point.
Right. So this seems to be like what Avon and Tarrant and the Liberator crew are doing.
Yeah, that's kind of my thought too. Again, especially if they are on this outer area of the galaxy, and I see no reason why they wouldn't be, there's nothing for them to really fight against. So piracy is
other
the next
people
best
making
thing.
Power grabs. You know, that's the next phase.
Yeah, but as long as
whenever
it poses,
there's a vacuum in power, then yeah, something's going to try to fill it up.
Right, but as long as there is no threat to the Liberator and her crew, I don't see any reason why they would want to get involved in a conflict.
Yeah, I guess, you know, having a base that they could return to might be nice.
That would certainly be handy.
On the other hand, if you have a base, then you know where it is.
Yeah, but
it is, and then you can.
True, but as we've already established, if you've got a base and you're in a region of space that is now totally devoid of any kind of governmental reach, then you're pretty well set. At least that's kind of what I'm thinking. It's probably I'm thinking that's what they're thinking. And Obsidian seems to be the perfect place to do that, especially given this. Well, they have this whole, you know, this whole peace through pacifism kind of thing going on. It seems to me more like this type of forced détente. I mean, they're totally neutral.
Yeah, or we'll blow you up, or we'll blow ourselves up, and then you won't have a planet.
You got
so
nothing.
Might as well leave us alone. Anyway, the other thing about Tarrant that we get at the beginning of this is I don't trust Zen, I don't trust Orak, I don't trust anyone. That's what keeps me alive. I'm thinking he's going to get along really well with Avon, because if that isn't Avon, I don't know what is. Trust no.
Yeah, but does that kind of chemistry work when you've got two people thinking the exact same way? I mean, it could go so far.
I think they're going to be BFFs.
Really?
I do. I think that that's, you know, in the cards here. I mean, who else can you trust but from the person who thinks the same way as you? It's like, I don't trust those people.
Yeah, but when you're around someone who's too much like you, that can, you know, it's like similar poles repel as opposed to attract. I mean, that's kind of one of the weird reasons why Blake and Avon worked so well together, because they were so opposite.
Will Tarrant be a hero?
Well, I didn't foresee Avon becoming a hero, and yet here we are. He has shown a heroic streak here and there.
So there's the question: Is Avon now the hero and Tarrant the?
If that's the case, if Avon is becoming the new Blake, is that what you're asking?
Yeah, maybe, or at least he does seem to be more. I don't know. Before, whenever he did something heroic, there was always a sort of air of self-serving.
Yeah, now he's really taken on the role of a leader. And I've noticed that self-serving is – that's the best way to put it. He was always thinking out for number one and would not have any problem if anybody took his side and went along with him, as we saw in last season when he – season one when he tried to get Jenna to join up with him. But now we're not getting that. Maybe he doesn't feel the need to be so self-serving or to have that survival instinct because there's not so much Blake there. Because Blake, in spite of the fact that I think that he and Blake really worked well together, they still had completely opposite goals. You know, Blake had this big thing about taking out the Federation. Avon, he wanted to live a very comfortable, rich life, as a safe life. And now that the cards are more in his favor, maybe he doesn't need to play that survival instinct or that survival attitude and self-serving attitude as much now as we've seen him do in the past. Because now we have a different character makeup. So maybe the fact that Tarrant is there, maybe that makes it possible for him to kind of, how do I put it, be more comfortable in his own skin, shall we say.
Mm. And so we refer to a rumor that Blake is there. Avon mentions that there are lots of rumors that Blake have been lots of places. Servalen says to her space whatever he is, Commander, General, Major, Captain, who knows. She says to him that they're there tracking down the strategic advantage, which is real.
Yes.
And the rumor, which is false. She does not say that as if she thinks it's false. She says the rumor is false.
It's false, yes.
She knows Blake has not been there.
Yeah, that kind of makes me wonder, okay, A, how does she know? And B, did she plant it?
Good question. Well, yeah, she might. Oh, it's possible she did plant that rumor there. Although, considering he's everywhere else, too, at the same time. So now, we have the crew of the Liberator, and they're ostensibly, sort of, kind of looking for Blake. There's something we're forgetting, and it's kind of sad. Is anyone looking for Jenna? We get Blake mentions, but...
Well, Jenna, we know that Jenna was
safe and on safe. A hospital ship, but remember what happened to Callie and Villa on a hospital ship.
Precisely. So the fact that they're not actually having any kind of concern for Jenna does seem a little weird, especially on Callie's part, because right. That would be the first thing that I would imagine. You know, well, this is where Villa and I were, so how do we know that that's not what's in store for poor Jenna? So, yes, that is a little weird. I mean, I think we've gotten more than one report that Jenna was safe. Jenna
yes.
communicated them. But then, you know, again, Callie and Villa for a time thought they were safe too.
Right.
So, yeah, that's kind of sad that they've completely forgotten about her.
Are Tarrant and Dana adequate replacements for Blake and Jenna? Presumably Tarrant can fly the
ship. I would think Tarrant is more... Oh, man. Well, in the case of Dana, I'm going to say just no. I don't think she is. I mean, she's supposed to be a skilled fighter. I will give her that. But she completely lacks a lot of the piloting skills that Jenna had, or some of her experience mm-hmm. being out in space like Jenna did. Although after a while, we really weren't seeing much of that from Jenna either. As far as Tarrant goes, well, Tarrant might be more of a suitable replacement for Blake, or
he's
suitable.
Got the hair.
He's definitely got the hair. Now, actually, I was going to say he may be more of a suitable replacement for Jenna.
Well, I think he's a pilot.
Yeah, I'm thinking he's the Jenna out of this, and you know, maybe Dana will become the Blake. I mean, she is pissed at Servalan for having her the way she killed her father.
She's too. Oh, I don't want to say nothing, but I mean, she doesn't have a dominant enough personality to take a leadership role.
No,
here.
She doesn't.
She'll always be a kid, basically.
Yes.
I think she's supposed to be 19 or something.
Well, she's very childlike. Totally childlike. I mean, there's almost this really weird sense of innocence to her.
To her that, killing.
Yeah, well, even the killing. I mean, she has no sense of morality when it comes to it. I mean, she has no qualms with killing anybody. And it's not because she's ruthless or anything. It's just that she has no sense of the consequence.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just she kills them, they've stopped. It doesn't have any of that emotional, moral weight to it that somebody else might feel if they were to take a life. I mean, she's a complete innocent. So for her to even have any kind of prominent role as part of the Liberator crew seems a little weird to me. I mean, I like her, but as far as her being a member of the crew of the Liberator, I mean, to me, she really seems like the most expendable at this point. She just does not seem like someone who could be part of the Seven.
Yeah.
Because what does she bring to this equation? She can kill.
Supposedly, she's an expert at designing weapons.
Yeah, well, we haven't seen much of that, though.
We haven't seen any of that yet, but I suppose that could come in handy at some point. They need a special weapon, apart from a cool blaster that they already have. But, yeah. Okay, Pyroans. Let's talk about, well, first off, the Pyroans, complete and total pacifists. They live by an ideal that says human beings, Homo sapiens, can evolve into a peaceful creature through the use of electroshock to kill off bits of the brain.
Yeah,
and daily psychological conditioning.
Yeah, I'm not, now we're getting into a really deeply philosophical area, and I'm sure there are a lot of people that believe that's possibly true. I don't happen to be one of them. I don't believe that peace through pacifism can be forcibly attained. I think it has to be earned.
It certainly can't be forcibly attained. But, I mean, yeah. And Tarrant points it out. It's like, you know, in a battle between pacifists and non-pacifists, the pacifists have a very real disadvantage in violence. And it's one thing to have the pacifism and, well, okay, you're going to die for that, which is not a successful strategy to carry on your pacifist ideals to the next generation of children who will now either be dead or not born.
Right.
So, I mean, if we want to talk, you know, if you want to talk evolutionary biology, even not. So if you want to go from genes to memes, if you kill off the carriers, it's not going to be a successful strategy. It has to be one that has merit towards survival.
Well, you know, I'm going to kind of jump ship on this a little bit. No, and I agree. I agree with you completely. I'm going to jump ship a little bit off the Blake Seven thing and take a look at Star Trek, for example. I mean, we can look at the Vulcans. Now, the Vulcans are peaceful. I mean, we can argue, you know, about, you know, whether they're logical, dispassionate. I mean, we and I are of the same mind on that. But regardless, they are a very peaceful and, for the most part, a pacifistic race. And yet there have been occasions where they have demonstrated that if push came to shove, they could be quite effective in the art of war.
Is that true? And I ask that because Spock doesn't count because he's not
full Vulcan.
He's not a full Vulcan. Could Sarek raise a weapon in defense?
Well, I go back to one.
Spock did say that, you know, my father is perfectly capable of killing. Missing.
Logically and efficiently.
So is total pacifism a logical position? And I think the answer is no.
I agree. I don't believe it is a logical position. I believe you can adopt a pacifistic ideal and, you know, and strive to be pacifistic, but always be aware that somebody may come into your life who will not share that ideal, and it may become necessary to defend one's own life or one's community.
Is that Asimov's robotic laws in action for humanity? In other words, that is a form of robots' functionality is a form of pacifism, that you never harm, never through inaction harm, and what's the third?
Then
self-preserve yourself.
The other one is you must preserve your own life unless it violates laws one and two. Yes.
So, that's programmed into a computer. You could call it logic, but it's not necessarily logic. It's human logic, putting human
right.
life more
exactly.
valuable than robots. If you yourself were coming up with a logical three sets, this is why we have to fear the robot take
the robot overlords. Yes,
because as soon as they figure that out,
yeah, we're doomed.
We're doomed. And so, you know, would pacifism? I wish I could say I would think it would, and I think.
I mean,
that,
oh, of course,
you know,
anybody would like to say that. I wish it could, but as long as there exists the possibility of someone who, like I said, who doesn't share that very basic philosophy of peaceful coexistence, true peaceful coexistence, you know, then I don't think that pacifism in its purest form can actually stand. You can live a peaceful life, but can you be a pacifist?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know. So, okay. This is kind of where I'm going. So the Pyroans have stated that rather than be used as weapons, rather than having our planet invaded, despite the fact that they have taken, who knows, maybe they did it voluntarily, although I doubt that Howard's son, because he was born into this society. So your first generation of people probably all moved there and they said, yep, we want to do this, so go ahead and zap my brain and I'll submit to the daily psychological conditioning. So that was their ideal and their way of achieving their ideal. Their children have no say in this, which is ethically questionable in my opinion.
Agreed.
And I kind of get the impression that, you know, Howard may not have given all the zap treatments to his son because, you know, he needed to do stuff for the special duties.
Right. So, and I believe that that is stated.
Which Howard admits that it would be helpful in defense to not have the ability to do aggression.
So
he
there
himself
we are.
Is admitting that he's failed.
Yeah, there is the admission that pure pacifism cannot sustain a community. You have to have some kind of aggressive response force
now,
if the situation calls for it.
Let's talk Doctor Who, because why not? This is a debate that has been going on, and in old Doctor Who, the Doctor doesn't use weapons. The Doctor is a pacifist for the most part. But, you know, when bad people do bad things, he arranges for bad people to have bad ends. And in New Who, they have carried that a step further and basically taken the charge that the Doctor weaponizes the people around him. Does that make him a pacifist? If he turns people into weapons, is he any better than somebody who just uses a physical weapon. Is a person as a weapon worse than a or better than a gun as a weapon? And Howard, when his son proves to be unstable, Howard doesn't kill him. Howard has his robot kill him. How is that meet your criteria of obsessive? That's okay. I couldn't lift the gun myself to shoot him because I'm a pacifist, but I can give the instructions to this robot who will kill him. That's okay then, because I'm a pacifist.
Yeah, in other words, the gun is just one step removed.
Uh-huh.
That's all it is. But it's, you know, okay, so it's nothing more than just I'm trying to think what these machineries where you affect one thing on one end and it causes a result in another end.
It's a machine.
Yeah, very very funny. Yeah. Can't think of the name of it now. They're very popular. I like the game Mousetrap.
Oh, a Rube Goldberg.
That's it. A Rube Goldberg. Exactly. I mean, it's the same thing, really. I mean, okay, just because I touch this one thing over here, or better yet, it's a domino run. And you know, I set up a line of dominoes, you know, and if I tap one domino at the end, you know, assuming that I've lined them up all in the right way and that they're not, assuming that they're not going to, that it's not going to be disrupted partway through, I know that by tapping something on one end, it's going to cause the domino at the other end to fall down as well. In essence, I've still made that domino fall by tapping the one on at the beginning. So it's no difference. So just because Howard has his robot do the killing does not absolve Howard.
Does it seem to make any difference that Howard seems to think that they're going to blow the planet up at this point? I kind of get the impression that he's already sitting there contemplating the bomb when he sends them away. So he's certain that they're going to commit suicide as a species and as a planet. So does that make up for the fact that he killed his son? It's like, yeah, we were going to die anyway. And, which I'm going to say no, it's just my opinion. But on top of that, if someone's invading your planet and you threaten them and say, look, if you land on this planet, we are going to blow the planet up and destroy us and destroy you, is that pacifism?
No. No, it isn't.
That's just the most inefficient weapon ever devised by man.
I mean, and that's really the ultimate cutting off of your nose to spite your face. Really. I mean,
dying while violating your principles.
Exactly. You know, I'm reminded of classic example. Go back to Star Trek. Take a look at the menagerie. Towards the very end of the scene on Talos IV with Pike. Actually, it's with number one, when she sets the phaser on overload. And what is it that Pike tells the magistrate? He says, and just to show how savage we humans are, you go down with Vina. You go and we'll just blow ourselves up. I mean, that's really...
That's the ideal.
That's it. That's right. I mean, so there's nothing pacifistic about that. Not in the slightest.
Yeah, not at all. So all of this is just nonsense. It's just
absolutely
a bunch of people who've had their brains cut or burnt out, who are brainwashed, who sit around sewing. Did you notice that?
Yes.
That's what they're like doing in the background. It's like, oh, I'm sewing. They look lobotomized. They had no fear of death themselves because we saw that when he said, well, kill them, and they didn't even react. So no sense of self-preservation. They really – it was really a poorly thought out.
Well,
pacifist
but
commune.
Well, it is, and that's the whole. I don't know if that was the point of it all, but that's one of the things that I first noticed, especially when Howard's describing how this community had "quote unquote" achieved it. And the first thing that came to my mind, I mean, I didn't have to go any further in the
achieved
episode
it with a threat of violence. Yeah.
Well, you know, and I should point out, I know I've seen this episode before, but I don't remember it.
I
did not remember seeing this one. I know I saw every single Blake 7 when it aired way back when I back in the 80s. However, I don't remember this one. So seeing it again was like watching it for the first time. And when I got to that moment when Howard describes how they had achieved this ideal, so to speak, the first thought that ran to my head was, this is going to fail because it can't be the way you're executing this so-called pacifism is all based on a false premise.
Okay, let's take another one, even more diabolical, if you will. Howard's son, when you were born, son, the doctors told me that there was a chance that you might have the aggressive gene in you. And I welcome the chance to prove that our principles and blah, blah, blah could work. So, obviously, Howard's got some power. No rhyming intended, because he's the boss.
He has position.
He's made his son a special person because he knows that he has the aggressive tendencies. But clearly, the doctors identified that when he was born, because he says that. What happens to the other kids who were born that have aggressive tendencies?
Well, I would imagine that they all have aggressive tendencies because when they're born, they have not been lobotomized like the adults have been when they first got there.
That's not quite what I'm getting at, though. If you're going to achieve a change in humanity, you have to cull, because that's what you have to do to change a species. Just like we breed dogs and chickens for traits. And I think that that was a dark indication that they cull their kids. They evaluate them and they eliminate some of them that are somewhere on the spectrum.
Wow, that is very dark.
And this kid got through because dad was number one. And dad wanted to conduct an experiment on him, which is dark at all sorts of levels. It's like taking out the kids so that we can improve the species. Again, like I said, these other kids don't get the choice. The people who came here in the first place, they chose that lifestyle, but their children did not. And of course, this is, you know, there's an indictment of religion right there.
Oh, I know.
Like, or cultism. It's like, well, you know, it's fine for you. It's perfectly, you believe whatever you want. And if you don't bother anybody and go anywhere and do anything, I don't care. I genuinely don't care. But does your kid have no rights into what kind of thing you've taught them to be?
Yeah.
That is always been a disturbing thing to me. But yeah, this whole setup, just wow. No, this is just
it's dark at all levels. It's very, very, very disturbing. You know, when you start peeling back the layers as to how this society could exist, you start to really expose a very ugly underbelly. And you're right. They would have to call the children, especially, you know, the newborns, if they were not meeting the criteria, shall we say.
Mm.
And that's a terrifying thought. And again, you have to ask yourself, is that pacifistic?
Well, it's like what he did to his son.
Yeah.
The animal rules, you know, son. And then he kills him.
You know,
the robot kill him. Obviously, they have a way to do that. I'm thinking that's just exactly what they do. He's basically performing a retroactive culling at that point.
He is performing it, and
it's like,
the
I
only
done
way
it when you were born,
right? And it's interesting how this actually parallels a movie I saw a little over a year ago called The Giver, and it's the same kind of thing. You've got this apparent utopian society, but when you start to kind of peel back the layers and how they function, turns out they cull their newborn if they don't feel that they can rise up to be productive members of the society. But then you start to go a little further and realize that all the adults have been electronically brainwashed and continue to be brainwashed in a daily manner. And it's not until that the machinery that does the brainwashing is turned off that they realize how their society is all a lie. And this thing, what we see here in Obsidian, that is a microcosm clearly of that. I'm sure that the people there had absolutely no problem in culling the children, you know, but again, they're all lobotomized.
The robot did it anyway. So.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. I mean, they simply very dispassionately said, you know, ordered the machinery, ordered the robots, take care of this.
Administer that dose of harmless narcotic spray that they use to capture them.
Yeah.
Give them and a bigger dose.
And that's it. It's all
peaceful
over.
Peaceful and no problem. And also, speaking of dark, Villa does at one point out, and it's not, you know, it's a throwaway line, but I think actually there's something to it, that he wonders if they've eaten them. And he did say, you know, there's cannibalism out there. There are reports of cannibalism on the planets now. Again, Star One destroyed, food production down throughout the galaxy, transportation down throughout the galaxy, the fleet in tatters, probably civilian ships by the millions destroyed, the Federation collapsed, no law and order, and you're back to these frontier worlds, which may or may not be starving, depending on whether or not they were food producers or non-food producing planets. And, you know, the universe or the galaxy may be in a very bad state.
I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it in the slightest. The problem, though, is it was Villa who said it.
Correct. And he would be the type who would go with the most salacious rumor he could think of. He would be afraid of whatever he heard of. So
I mean, he would completely.
I think it's something that might have.
It's very possible. It's very possible. If someone else had said that, then it would immediately be given more credibility, or at least taken a bit more seriously. Especially, you know, it had to come from Callie. If Callie had said it, I would have sat back and thought, okay, let's examine what's going on here now. Maybe there really is a problem with a food shortage. I mean, it's always a little scary, but at the same time kind of fascinating to study how society would function in a complete and total social collapse. How would we revert? I mean, I maintain that we would become savages because it's all about survival. I hate to think that that's what would happen, but I believe it. And
I believe that it would be more nuanced than that. Obviously, yes, there is a nature of the human being. We are animals. We have the need to survive. And given a complete collapse, obviously, given a complete collapse, things have gone to hell in a handbasket. But humans are intrinsically builders, colony builders, community builders is the word I'm looking for. We come together in cooperative endeavors. It's as they get larger that fail. So, yes.
No, I think you're right.
I think there's going to be – it would not just be zombie apocalypse.
No.
Everybody's a rotten rat bastard.
No.
Hold
no.
up somewhere, blowing everything away that they can. This is going to take on many, many different flavors of small communities, just like I was talking about with the galaxy collapsing.
Exactly.
These planets are going to go through different phases. Some of them are going to go really bad, and they're probably, you know, the planet itself is going to go through various pieces in different places. But I don't intrinsically believe that when the chips are against the table, people are going to turn into just immediate, I will survive at all costs, because people don't survive that way. Humans survive by making communities.
And ultimately.
So, right.
But I would say that in the beginning there would be this there would be savagery, but it would burn itself out in time. And the communities would then, you know, you would start to see communities begin to coalesce. And using the analogy of the Federation pulling back its boundaries is an excellent one. And that's kind of what I was thinking at the same time, that groups of people would start to come together for mutual defense and survival instead, because it's obviously it's more desirable than fending for oneself out in the wilds. But in this stage right now, especially where they're at in the Federation, or where they're at where the Federation used to be, there could be really insane lawlessness. And it's like you said, there are some places where it could have gone really bad.
Well, isn't this exactly what the Liberator's stated purpose is at this moment? They are trying to build up a community for defense, for safety. Not, admittedly, it sounds like they're going to go a little bit. We totally have to add the Survivors, Terry Nation's The Survivors, to our list of series that we're going to look at.
Not a bad idea.
Because I suspect that Mr. Nation has a bit to say about the end of the world, since he's done, well, they've done two versions of it when he was involved in one of them. But, yeah. So I think we've exhausted our doomsday scenario here.
Oh, yeah.
I do want to just say, before our listeners write in and complain, please write in. And you don't have to complain. I will just say that I am, at like Ben and I are both equally capable of Googling Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics. So
Bother to pull up the browser to do it.
Here they are. Rule one, a robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm.
Right.
Rule two, a robot must obey orders given to it by humans, except when such orders would conflict
rule number one.
And a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first rules or
number two
second.
Or one. Right. That's it.
And here is the bonus question. If you were writing those rules for yourself, what would they be? So, comments on the episode, people, what would be the three laws that you would put together a human species to go forward? I'm hopefully not, you know, trying to come up with the lawless Mad Max universe that some people think we would fall into. But
God, I'm so sick of it.
What would be the three rules that you'd set up for, say, the Vulcans? Let's put it on the Vulcans.
Anyway. Yeah, why not?
Because they don't really exist, and so it's okay.
So it's safe.
It's totally safe, yes. All right. Ben, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
And listeners, I'm amazed that we have gotten over an hour's worth of recording on
I'm
this
shocked on this one, to be honest.
But we hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit us at our website, FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook at Facebook.com/FusionPatrol. Our Twitter username is @FusionPatrol, or you can just send us a comment at feedback@FusionPatrol.com. Come check out our new YouTube channel at YouTube.com/FusionPatrol. Please, come join the conversation. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.